Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. This episode is from the Momentum Series, resurfacing the most popular episodes from our archives to shine a light on the continued growth of companies in our network. And now, on to the show.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. Super excited. Today we have with us Katarina Axelsson, founder and CEO at Tastry. Katarina, thank you for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. And with that, so let's jump right into it. Would love to hear what inspired you to start Tastry and how you came up with the idea.
Sure. Yeah, I did not go into this looking just to start a business or to be an entrepreneur. I was in college and tinkering around the lab I was working at as an aspiring scientist and ended up reading a lot of research papers in my free time based on what was going on in the sensory industry and how CPG or FMCG type companies were doing R&D to mitigate the high failure rate of launching new products. And it all came down to anticipating what the consumer is going to like and want. And the answer lies in the chemistry. So it was just, I just ended up looking at the analytical chemistry methodologies for analyzing products and predicting how consumers would perceive them. And I came up with this notion that consumers are unreliable in verbalizing what they're experiencing. And we all have a very different experience when tasting or smelling something, and language is not adequate. But the good news is that it's irrelevant in being able to predict whether or not you like something. And there was a lot of research out there from the top companies, the flavor and fragrance companies, looking at what chemistries equal what flavors, but there was very little research on what chemistries equal likability, if that makes sense. The issue was, I don't think the problem was addressed because machines don't look at chemistry the same way humans do. So long story short, it was just like a rabbit hole that turned into an invention that would allow us to look at a flavor matrix of a product and relate it to the human palate and preferences. And because of that invention, we ended up doing a lot of research for many years with a team of scientists and building a business model around that invention, if you will. So that's how it happened. That's where the inspiration came.
Okay. And out of curiosity, how much of our subconscious or unconsciously are we influencing our preferences for certain tastes, certain fragrances?
Do you mean like from childhood experiences or your current mood or emotion at the time, that kind of thing?
I'd imagine there's any number of different inputs that influence what our preferences are. I've come across different articles that would suggest that our brain is making decisions before we even realize it. And So I can't help but wonder whether or not there's a degree of unconscious bias that we have and whether or not it's easy or hard to flush those out.
Yeah, no, look, I'd love to hook consumers up to a QEEG or something and do that kind of research. But just from a commercial entrepreneur standpoint, we feel like the way we capture that is by understanding what your inherent preferences are for foods and flavors already, not necessarily knowing the reason. So it could be that I hate bell peppers, right? Because my sister hit me when I was a child when I had bell peppers, but that doesn't really matter to us. What matters to us is that I do know I hate bell peppers, and that information can be used as an analog to predict what other chemistries I may or may not like. But I think there is definitely a nature versus nurture component, and nurture gives us a really big, non-trivial amount of visibility on whether or not you're going to like something. So you're right, if you're, I don't know, an immigrant from Japan and you grew up eating natto and other Japanese foods, and you come to the US, even though you're the same demographic as another Japanese person who you're not going to have the same preferences because the person who grew up in America grew up eating burgers and milkshakes, right? So there's a nurture component. I don't know if I'm answering your question
No,
exactly.
you are. Basically, so said another way, what I heard is for purposes of bringing the or addressing the opportunity to better match consumers with products that they may like, the focus is on what versus why.
But I think, yeah, but I think you're really on to something here. And what I mean by that is there is a more conscious reaction that you will have to something you dislike. And that is part of our secret sauce, actually, is we operate under this assumption that people don't like what they don't like more than they like what they like. Our algorithms and our technology is really built around figuring out what the deal breakers are, because there are latent variables that determine how much you like something, right? If I'm in a good mood and I'm drinking a wine, then I'm going to rate it slightly higher than if I were in a bad mood. But the key is, if there's something I hate, let's say it's blue cheese or something like that, even on the best day of my life, I'm not going to love that. So it's all about figuring out what detectable dislikability there is and then building everything around that.
Understood. So then as you think about building on the logic that you've figured out and incorporated in the product, what's the long-term vision for the company?
Yeah, so it's a very lofty, it's a very big vision. And really, we started using this data because there's a lot of applications for it. A lot of companies along the supply chain want to anticipate consumer preferences and demand, but we started in production. So we started in product development, but and we have done that successfully. But the bigger vision is, how do we shepherd these products across the supply chain as efficiently as possible? That means we have to engage with other parts of the supply chain, like the retailers, the distributors, the people selling the products to consumers. So we're working on vertical integration. And when we succeed at engaging with retailers and distributors, et cetera, then we become more valuable to everyone involved in that supply chain. We would be like a layer of information that supply chain can react to real time. Because it's one thing to make an amazing product that consumers are going to, but that's only part of the puzzle, right? The other part is, how do you get it to those consumers? Where are they located? How do you sell it to them? All those things impact success. Yeah, our vision is to have a flywheel of information for the supply chain real time.
Without question, it's really easy to see your value proposition. But like many founders, there's still the work and having to validate the idea in the early stages. How did you go about doing that?
Oh, it was a complete nightmare. I'm not going to dance around that. It's one thing I thought as a first-time founder when I started this, that the hard part would be spending all the money and time on building the revolutionary technology and demonstrating the efficacy. And rationally, right, if you demonstrate the efficacy, then that means that you're going to get adoption because the value proposition is so strong. But there are other competing factors that we had to consider. Like, one, what is the level of sophistication of the industry in integrating this technology into their workflow, right? What is people's perception of this? How do you change the way someone has been doing something in their career for the past 35 years, right? That doesn't happen overnight. The way we went about it is through having many meetings and conversations with the stakeholders we were trying to sell to, iterating the product to quote unquote meet them where they're at. And a lot of evangelization and education. So it's almost we had to anneal the market before reaching product market fit. And that might be that because we're working with some traditional industries, it might just be that compared to an AI company, any industry is a traditional industry, and it takes time to figure out how to implement that into a system that's already working, if that makes sense.
It makes total sense. And I think for the benefit of other founders who are listening to this, it iterates the key word. I think a lot of times we start a business with a recognition of who our ideal client profile is, only to find out later on that it's different. And so with that, I'd love to hear what your experience was, who you originally thought was going to be purchasing the product and who it turned out to be.
I would always say we had this lofty vision of using data to shepherd the product across the supply chain, but we started selling to winemakers or product development R&D people because we figured if we could not get them on board, then the system wasn't going to work. We had to build their trust because if they weren't going to use it, then we'd fail at step one, right? And it was also the hardest place to start because 5 years ago, if you asked if a winemaker would be looking at a computer when making wine, people would laugh at you. Yeah, that's where we started. But now that we have traction there, everything else is easier. The adoption rate is so much easier.
And so then, as you think about scaling the company, how have you thought about mechanisms for growth?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I would say step one, we brick by brick obtain valuable logos and companies who are in production in the space. Step two is we have aligned with the gatekeepers that these companies are trying to sell to. So we started with kind of a push effect, like here, look at my data, buy and carry my product. But now we're looking at talking and are working directly with the retailers and distributors because once they have the data on board, then that's going to motivate even more brands or suppliers to work with us, right? Yeah, aligning really my obsession has been how do I accelerate the adoption rate? And that's been the way to do it, is to talk to the people that are valuable to the clients that you have.
And with that, I think there are a lot of founders who love your thoughts on this. You generally find that momentum is real and that as you continue to press forward, it's been picking up.
It does. There's a, I don't know how to describe it. It's, you almost get like a feeling before the numbers come in, like the numbers of are a lagging indicator, if that makes sense. Things just start to feel like easier, like less cumbersome. You don't spend as much time explaining what the product is, what you're doing. I wish there were words to describe it, but yes, momentum is a real thing, and you will, I have personally felt it before the numbers have come in.
Okay. And as it relates to numbers, feedback is essential for any business. What KPIs, metrics have you used to get feedback on your efforts?
Yeah, and I will preface this, it's going to be completely different for every business out there, what I think metrics matter. But at the moment, we're very much a consumption-based SaaS model. So for us, we have the typical CAC to LTV ratio that look at the sales cycle. That's one way we're really looking at, are we or are we not accelerating the adoption rate? The other thing is contract renewals for us. As an emerging technology, right, our initial contract might not be that high. It's just going to be like, hey, we're just going to test this and see what happens. But a big thing we look for is what is the size of the second contract, right? How many X, how much more is the contract the second time around? And if is that number increasing or decreasing?
And so said another way, part of your strategy has been, hey, let's get our foot in the door and then we can land and expand. Is
Yeah,
that?
definitely. Definitely.
And so when I think about return on CAC, customer lifetime value over customer acquisition costs, a lot of different opinions on what's a worthwhile ROI. For argument's sake, let's say it's somewhere between 3 to 5 to 1. What's your opinion? And I'd also just love to hear if you feel like it, your opinion's changed over the years, meaning, hey, I just need to make a sale regardless of what this is going to return to me in the beginning.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how useful my particular insight would be because we have an amazing margins. Our CAC is very low, including the time investment of the salesperson and the meetings. We make our money back very quickly, even in the first sale. But what is our issue or focus is how do we grow that as quickly as possible over time? So maybe it's just not enough of a metric for us to be looking at, right? It's CAC to LTV is not enough. I don't know if that makes sense. I'm trying
It
to figure
does.
out how to rephrase that. Yeah, there's also this component where we have this subscription for annual use of our dashboard. And then I have to look at, are we counting churn properly? That's a really big metric for us, right? Because If a customer doesn't renew the contract within 12 months, then that counts as a churn, right? But sometimes our customers will take 13 or 14 months and then unchurn, right? I wish I had a good answer for that.
In our own experience working with our clients, I think what I hear you describing is similar. We have clients who more closely resemble a subscription, and they may have a month gap. As you treat the when they come back on as a new sale or a continuation. And I've had that conversation with board members and with investors herself. And I think the short of it is it really just depends on the nature of the business before you decide. But as long as you're consistent with its application, I think it's a great way forward. And so with that, let's talk about board and investors. Love to hear what your experience has been on finance.
Definitely an unusual one. I think we have been very fortunate. I have had many opportunities to take the venture route throughout working on Tastry, and it never just felt quite right to go the venture route because of the uniqueness of our business and emerging technology in a traditional industry. It just takes too much time to establish ourselves, and it just felt like it would not be a prudent to have a stricter timeline for this business that venture would expect. It would not be good for the business. And the other reason is we were able to make such a luxurious choice, if you will, because our investors are private investors and the LP types of investors that these funds would typically fundraise from. So it had this relationship, this close relationship with my investors who don't really run out of money, and we track progress. And when we need capital to reach another milestone, it's pretty available to us. So I don't want to sound too spicy, but it's almost like we cut the middleman out.
I also, to your credit, it's a mature response. It's a mature response because I get the sense that it's the exception that a founder understands that venture capital has a time expectation associated with it. And kudos to you for recognizing that, but then also saying, hey, we may not be the best fit right now.
Yeah, we were fortunate to be able to make that choice, I would say.
And so with that, with your existing private investors, what did you look for in them and make sure that there was alignment between expectations?
Yeah, that's really important. I've definitely turned down more money than I have accepted. I've just seen too many horror stories between founders and investors from in the startup community to not be wary of that. I've seen startups die for the dumbest reasons over stuff like that. What we were really looking for, I would say, I have some very trusted advisors, but they were very cautious and slow to offer advice. This has been unknown territory. You could say we are an expert in this field. This has not been done before. This has not existed before. And I have found a lot of people who have been successful in the past, they apply their roadmap for their success to everything else they do in the future. And there's just too many nuances to do that. So my investors and advisors really did quite a deep dive on what we're doing and what's going on before collaborating with us, if you like, if that makes sense.
Due diligence is extremely valuable. Also recognizing when you're in uncharted territory and being able to assign a degree of risk. But it sounds like they made a great bet because super impressed with what I've heard and that you shared on this call. And we'll talk more about how people can find out here before we wrap up. But with that, biggest challenge you've faced so far, and how'd you overcome it?
Yeah, there's so many challenges all the time, right? I don't think it's ever going to stop when you're running a startup. Everyone says it's so hard. Oh my God, it's so hard, but it really is. It's so hard. I would say personally, or for the company, personally, my biggest challenge is this in sense of responsibility for all the people and investors involved. That weighs on a founder heavily. The challenge for the business is we're growing, right? And we are getting adoption, but people do not move as fast as technology does. So we find ourselves obsessed with how do we take the progress we're making and accelerate it because it's happening. And there will be a tipping point at some point where this becomes ubiquitous. But how long do we want to wait for that? How do we speed things up? And I don't think that's unique for AI companies. I think the adoption rate is a little unpredictable right now for any AI company as organizations are trying to figure out how to work with this. So yeah, constant obsession and challenge.
I inferred a commitment to your team. And so I'd love to hear your thoughts on how you think about attracting and retaining top talent.
Yeah, we've had amazing retention. I'm trying to, I keep thinking about why. We've had amazing people who had so many other options to go work in big tech, and their talent would definitely be useful elsewhere. I think there's just a allure to working in a startup in a small company for self-starter type people. You can't really bribe genius, you know what I mean? And I think we retain talent because everything you do in this company, if you are one person, what you're doing is extremely valuable. And if you're a self-starter type person who can work in a flexible environment, you're going to understand your potential a lot faster. We just have a good culture. Yeah, I'll think of some other reasons, but that's what comes front of mind.
Okay. No, I think that's it's a brilliant answer. Culture absolutely plays a part. My sense is at the end of the day, people want to win. And so with that, let me ask, obviously a tremendous amount of demands between service delivery, product development, sales and marketing, just running the company. How do you prioritize that?
Piece, I would say piece by piece, it really is. It just depends. I think that changes every 3 months, right? I would say I get a lot of help by getting efficient information on what's going on in the company to help me decide what to prioritize every 3 months. Every morning I wake up and I think about what is it that I'm doing that could be a job for someone else. And I'm pretty, we just, it works for a small company. You have very capable people that understand subsets of the company. And if I have the right people who can deliver information to me quickly, it's a lot easier to prioritize quickly. But I don't think there's any way around constantly changing priorities in a startup. That's going to happen. You're nimble and things get messy. That's, I would say, short answer. The way I prioritize is by setting up a system or an org chart where I can get information as quickly and efficiently as possible.
Okay. No, it makes great sense. And that's definitely an advantage of being an early stage company is that you can be quick and fast. And so taking advantage of that, 100% agreed is wise. So then team looks for you. I'd love to hear top leadership lessons that you've taken away since you started the company.
So for me personally, one would be going back to what we talked about a while ago, take advice from experts with a grain of salt. People love giving advice, and you have to be careful because if they don't have skin in the game with you, their advice might not be as valuable. And I'm not saying advice is not valuable. I'm just saying many very brilliant people can completely disagree on the same topic. So you do have to nurture your own intuition to make decisions and not rely on advisors completely. That's definitely a big one. I think there was, what was another one on a leadership? Sorry. Yeah, I think for me, I was definitely on the hands-off side of the spectrum when I started. So I would carefully curate like these brilliant people who would fit with my company culture and come into my company and work at the company, right? At a founder, co-founder, whatever level. And I think as the company grew and we added more people, I realized that not everyone can be very self-starter, and you can't just go to everyone and say, hey, this is the problem. Go figure it out. Come back to me. You're smart enough. I know you're going to figure it out. And I realize as you add more people, you have to start to become a little bit more precise on how you provide direction and manage people. And not everyone is comfortable with that kind of lack of structure. Some people need more reassurance. So I think it's just, you just have to change your management style depending on the size of the company and how the company grows. You can't have a company that's 100% self-starter. I'm going to figure everything out. You don't need to tell me what to do or provide any direction. And that's not going to last forever. So I had to learn that piece.
I've heard that before, having to walk, it's a balance, walking the line between enabling smart and effective people to be creative and do their job, but at the same time, being able to ensure that everyone is headed in the right direction. Last question before we wrap up. It's been a great podcast. What advice would you give to any aspiring entrepreneurs out there before they get started?
This is, again, take advice with a grain of salt. So this is just coming from my personal experience. I would say just be prepared to iterate more than you thought. I would say, just from what I have seen personally, it's very rare that your first product launch or feature, whatever, or attempt to sell the product into the market is going to be the right one. And I've just seen personally too many times, too many founders just iterate a couple of times and then give up. And I think that people give up too soon. So don't be discouraged by having to do many iterations to get it right. It might be harder at first, but that also means it's harder for everyone else, and that's the advantage for your particular business, is the barrier to entry.
Sage advice, 100% agreed. Katarina, if people want to get a hold of you, how can they find you?
So I'm on X. I'm Katarina Axelson, Axelson. So I'm on X. I'm very big on LinkedIn. And so I'm always happy to chat.
Fantastic. Katarina, thank you so much for being a guest on the podcast. Again, for our audience, Katarina Axelson, founder and CEO at Tastree. Thank you so much. Another episode of the Innovators Investors Podcast. Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com/podcast-guest. If you've got something out of this interview, please share this episode on social media. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.